Well, I've seen it because in just my time in Pipestone, for example, we took PERS incidence or infectivity rate down below 10% for 3 years. And so that was amazing to go into those farms that don't have PERS. They haven't had PERS for several years, to see that welfare in the animals and the health of the animals, how welfarious it is, to see the smiles on the faces of the workers there, the pig caretakers, where they weren't carrying out buckets of dead pigs and dead sows all the time. They were actually going year after year after year without PERS. And then just to see the owners and their and the generations of new ownership thinking about coming back to the farm. Yeah, yeah. It sounds like it's a lot better place than it used to be.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai. AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Summer challenges finish your pig performance. Digestrum Finish can help. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/finish. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Your pork checkoff is all in on improving U.S. swine health. Learn more at porkcheckoff.org/strategy.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Swine It podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Donovan, your host, and I'm excited about my guest today, Dr. Scott D. Dr. D is Emeritus Director Professor at the University of Minnesota in Pipestone Research. Dr. D has made a significant contributions to the swine industry through his extensive body of published research, a multitude of scientific presentations. His expertise is recognized not only as a researcher and professor, but also as an advisor to graduate students and mentor to swine professionals in the field like myself. Scott, it's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Well, thank you, Tara. It's great to see you. I haven't seen you for a while, and here you are. And I'm really happy to be here. It's a real honor for me. So thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. So today, Scott and I are going to talk about a world without PERS. But before we get started, Dr. D, given your vast roles in the swine industry, I'm confident most of our listeners already know you. But I'd like you to share just a little bit more detail about your career and depth of service to the swine industry.
Yeah, so I have a really serpentine, experiences in the swine industry. I'm not from a farm. I grew up in the city of Rochester, Minnesota, which is right near the Mayo Clinic, if anybody's been to the Mayo. And I went to vet school at the University of Minnesota. I didn't get in right away. I did a master's while I was waiting to get in. Met Al Lehman, Hansu Chu, Carlos Pijuan, Bob Morrison, and got, immersed in that University of Minnesota swine group culture. And I just loved that atmosphere and I loved that attitude. So when I graduated in 87, I was going pigs all the way. And I also loved pig producers because the time I spent on pig farms learning about how it all worked, they were really friendly to me and they didn't laugh at me too much. They like kind of little left field ideas I'd throw out there. So with that, I'm going pigs. And I graduated in 87 into a swine practice in West Central Minnesota. PERS emerged that same year. I got immersed and drowned in it, basically, the next 12 years of my life. Went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota, did my PhD to try to become a better thinker, worked on things like nursery depopulation, gilt acclimatization, breeding herd subpopulations, all of these basic fundamental blocking and tackling we use today in our PERS control program. Got bored in practice and went to the university to try to expand all that research in indirect transmission of PERS, because back in those days, which is about what 1999 and 2000, all we really knew was infected pigs and contaminated semen could transmit the virus. We had no idea about any other way it could move around. So with some of my grad students, we worked on transport, supplies, people coming in, the fomite stuff. We worked on the airborne and we worked on the feed. when I was later on at Pipestone. So I've been kind of working on transmission and biosecurity my entire career, studying routes of transmission and then developing and validating protocols for preventing introduction. So after 12 years at the university, I wanted to take that all into the real world. I went back to Pipestone, became the research director, and we applied all of those protocols across the Pipestone system, which I think everyone might know. It's about 75 breeding herds, about 400,000 sows. So I really wanted to see, Tara, like you know, you're a field person too. Does all this stuff we've really generated in the university work? And if it does, great. If it doesn't, what are we going to do about it? So long answer, but I've had this long and winding road kind of from the Beatles side of my right brain. And it's been a riot. I've had just a blast in my career. So that's real quick and dirty. So any other questions or details you need, let me know.
For more than 50 years, KT Pacer has built feed transportation equipment focused on quality, performance, and reliability. Today, we continue to innovate with our Flow Trailer platform, engineered for durability, lightweight performance, and easy maintenance. Designed to maximize on-farm efficiency and reduce total cost of ownership, KT Pacer trailers help feed operations move more, improve productivity, and spend less. KT Pacer, built to meet the demands of modern agriculture. Learn more at ktpacer.com.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, it's, I can't remember an AASV or a meeting without you presenting something new on, you know, PERS and biosecurity and how we can need to look at it a little bit differently. So definitely appreciate all of that knowledge and was always excited to go back and try the next thing. So given your vast experience and leadership, I know we can get to a world without PERS. So I'm excited about today's conversation. So when I got out of school and started in my career late 90s, we already had PERS, like you said, infecting farms across the U.S. We knew semen was a route of infection. But compare the early days of PERS to today's PERS in terms of what we saw on farms and kind of, you know, just give our audience a little bit of that background of what we see in that virus change and why it's so important that we work on eradication.
Yeah. So back in 87, 88, you know, we'd never seen anything like this. This was, you know, reproductive failure, respiratory failure. The farms were all one site. They were small. We'd never seen anything like it. And it was devastating at that time, mentally, but also to the animals, but mentally for the farmers and the veterinarians, because we didn't know what we were dealing with. We had no idea it was a virus. We thought it might have been a mycotoxin or a bacteria or something. Nobody knew what to do. And the swine industry really fought each other during that time. They weren't working together, which was really tough for me to watch as a young graduate. But over time, you know, it was figured out it was a virus. And off we went, and we started doing the things I just described with some other great work, too, on oral fluid surveillance and vaccine development and all these other important pieces of the puzzle. But to your question, where are we now? We've seen this virus change and mutate about every 3 or 4 years. There appeared to be a new virus. You know, it'd pop up. Maybe it was 144, then it went to 184, then it went to 174, and down the road we go. But now we've developed these new viruses, which I think are far worse than we've ever seen before. So the clinical impact on the animal, it's so bad now. It's an animal welfare issue. It's not just a disease or an economic issue. It still is, but it's become an animal welfare issue. And that's why I think right now is a very different situation than we've ever had before. This is no longer just disease. This is welfare. And that to me is a real serious line now we've crossed, and we got to do something about it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And not to mention, you know, the increased use of antibiotics to try to help us, you know, not really even, I can't even say you cure a pig with PERS, you just try to improve their survivability, right? And so, but the use of antibiotics to defend all the other bacterials that take advantage, you know, that's a big issue in my opinion as well.
That's exactly right. It's far worse than it used to be. And the antibiotic resistance challenge is, you know, that's a very important point. So I'm glad you raised it.
So, Scott, you published a couple of articles where you compared herds with what you called next generation biosecurity. And so these were herds that had, you know, some basic level of biosecurity, but then others that had what I, you know, what you call next generation or enhanced. Tell us a little bit about that and how that leads us to we know how to get rid of PRRS, right, and how to keep it out.
Sure. So back in 2000 or so, we knew how PRRS was transmitted again by animals and semen. And then the breeding stock companies, to their credit, cleaned up a lot of their pyramids and they had negative breeding stock now to sell, which was awesome because now we could depop farms and bring in negative animals and clean it up. So we thought we had it, the world by the tail. But we realized very shortly, and I imagine you know about this story, the virus was still getting into farms and it was a new virus. It wasn't the old one. You know, we could sequence back then, by that time back then. We saw this isn't the same virus we had before. It's a new one. It got in and we have no idea how it got in. So we started calling at area spread. I think Monsieur Tremare from PIC at the time, who was leading their cleanup plan, called it area spread. And so I put it to myself that I have to understand area spread or we're never going to convince producers to clean up their farms. Because why clean up when you're going to get it back right away and not even know where it came from? So that's where we did all that work on the indirect routes, I call them, again, the fomite base, the transport, et cetera, the air, et cetera, the feed, et cetera. We now understand at the end of that process what we call next generation PRRS biosecurity. And these are protocols that have been validated across all of those routes and published in peer-reviewed journals, which showing that it actually works. And we take all that together. So we take negative breeding stock and negative semen. We test it in a quarantine. We put in transport sanitation. We put in personnel shower in, shower out. We put in D&D rooms for supplies. We manage the fomite side with science-based protocols. We put filtration in for the airborne route. And we put a mitigant in for the feedborne route. So we take this next generation is taking all of that information and putting it in a comprehensive plan. And so to your point, I did the reason I went to Pipestone was to take this idea and put it across the entire system and see if it actually worked. And what we learned was it worked really well. However, we can talk about it some more. We had a group of farms that were using the whole plan. Now, we had a group of farms that were not using, say, air filtration, everything but air filtration. So we were able to look at two groups, you know, two cohorts across the entire company. Again, 75 breeding herds, 400,000 sows roughly, and really look at what works or not. And it was very obvious that the next generation, the complete plan, worked extremely well. And the incomplete, we call it incomplete. We still had quite a bit of infection. So it really showed that you got to put this whole thing together. And if you can do that, then you can measure. And the publications we put out showed that if we do this together, even with the incomplete and the complete together, we still took the PRRS infection rate down below 10%. So 8% incidence risk, meaning the 8% introduction of new viruses, had never been proven before. So that was like, holy moly. You know, we actually do understand how this thing moves. We do understand how to stop it. And if we do, again, not perfect, but we can really get that infection rate or that incidence risk, it's called, down to a manageable level where it doesn't cripple the entire company. So that had never been done before. And so that's why I wanted to write those papers, because I wanted to put it in peer review. So once it's there, it stays there and people can use it then to hopefully help themselves. So that's kind of what we learned when we compared this complete versus incomplete program. Again, the first time it had been done before. So I was really excited at that point.
And so that article and my take on it, or, you know, publication in historical following those farms and seeing what their incidence rate is, tells us, you know, within an area, within a production system, you can improve your incidence of PRRS. You can keep it out. You can do enhancements. So what about the industry? What do you see the industry needing to do? And where do we expand upon that? Not just the farm level biosecurity, but you know, the industry wide, what are some areas we need to work on there?
Yeah. So the value of those papers and that experience, which again was a 3-year assessment across this big company, it's not like a little university trial, or it shows that we can do it. It proves that we can control PERS at a level that we've never been able to control before. So to me, it's having proof of concept is really important to show that we're not just, you know, making stuff up. We can actually do this. We can actually control the disease if we follow these protocols. So first, the industry just has to realize that, you know, it has to realize that this is no longer just a pipe dream. This is something that can actually be done if you follow these specific details and the science. So that was really important. The thing we have to do now, I believe, is first cast a vision for elimination of PERS across the United States. And like my colleague Gordon Sprague called it, a world without PERS. Now that's a vision that we've never had before. We have to cast that vision. Then we have to start building confidence within the industry that that vision can be realized. But we're going to have to do some things that we may not have had to do before. We're going to have certain non-negotiables that we simply have to change the way we behave. So first, we have to believe it can be done. That's not easy. That's not easy at all. And then we have to realize that, okay, if we're going to, we can do this, these are some of the tactics we have to employ that, you know, we simply can't do some of this stuff anymore. We got to follow this path and not follow this path. So it's, first of all, cast a vision, believe it can be done, build a critical mass, and then figure out what are the tactics we have to employ.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right on the vision has to be there, right? Because we really need everybody, all hands on deck, so to speak, right? The whole industry to do this as a concerted effort. And the producers really have to be the lead or the ones that want to take initiative and get it done. Because in the end, it's their farms and their expense, right? And change in what we have to do differently. Maybe one example for the audience would be in your article about those non-negotiables, you talk about, you know, stop movement of infected pigs. Well, how could we do that, Scott? How would that, you know, is that plausible and why is it important?
Yeah, so it's important because that's been well documented to be the easiest way to spread PERS. You know, you can talk about air and you can talk about feed, but none of that is as significant as actually moving infected pigs into a negative area, letting them spread virus in the neighborhood and just infecting farm after farm. So that's been really well documented experimentally. So we have to do that. So how do we do that? We've had experience somewhat, and I give the late Bob Morrison credit, with area projects where some of the listeners might remember where there were certain parts of the USA where producers and veterinarians were actually working together. And they'd kind of come up with an area project that where they were sharing information, they were sharing test results, they were talking to each other about, hey, I got these pigs and I got to move them. They're infected. Can we work together? Can we use a barn here? Can we share something there? That was actually really working. And I credit Bob for that. The breakdown we had, though, Tara, was we didn't know the area spread answer at that time, and the virus is moving in ways that we couldn't control or didn't understand. Now we know, based on the work we talked about a few minutes ago, we know how this thing moves around. So we know what you have to do to biosecure your farm. But it really comes down to working together. And I think that's, you look at the pseudorabies history, pilot projects of producers working together was one of the big learnings that came out of that was, you know, we got to do this together as a team. We can't do it by ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you kind of think about, well, you know, if I have a farm get infected, I only have these wean to finish barns in this location or these nurseries here. What are my options? And unless you're having those conversations beforehand, what, you know, Dr. Main would call in peacetime, you don't know what your options are. And so, like you mentioned, you know, Bob's whole vision was, you know, everybody has to be talking to each other frequently and knowing what inputs they have and what can be done. If my farm breaks, what would I do? And so you have a plan, right? Prior plan.
Yep. And the beauty of this now is the producers are leading it. So the National Pork Board and the National Pork Producers Council are organizing this effort. And it's not the veterinarians, it's not the government, it's the farmers. And that's what was missing. You know, 20 years ago, I posed this idea when I was the president of the ASV. Let's eliminate this thing, which is a great idea, but it was too far ahead of its time. We didn't know area spread outcomes at the time. We had no producer leadership at the time. Now we have, we didn't have U.S. SHIP at the time. So now we've got a lot of tools and a different culture that I think will really help us make strides in a positive way. So it's coming down to the farmers, and the vets just got to get on board and help their customers get what they want.
Yeah, I agree. So you mentioned U.S. SHIP. So U.S. SHIP is the U.S. Swine Health Improvement Plan. Tell us why that's important to get involved in SHIP.
Yeah, so a lot of credit there to Dr. Roger Main, a lot of people at Iowa State University, the USDA now is getting involved. That's a platform where we've got farms enrolled in a program originally for transboundary disease prevention, ASF, CSF. But to me and a lot of other people, this is a great way to work together on domestic diseases, on endemic diseases such as PRRS and PED. Let's get all these farms enrolled in U.S. SHIP. They start communicating. They start sharing. They're part of a group that votes and meets regularly. Let's start working there. Let's start working with, you know, these controlling these other diseases at the domestic level. It'll give us a great practice. If we ever get ASF or CSF, we'll know if this works or not. Let's start there and really build this critical mass of producers working together. It's so exciting to me. We've never had that before. And so I think this is what I call a non-negotiable. We have to have producers joining U.S. SHIP. A high majority. I think everybody should be part of U.S. SHIP and get their farms registered, get them in the program, start sharing information, et cetera, et cetera. So that's something we didn't have. And so I'm excited about that because we got to have a platform. We got to have a way to work together if we're going to go anywhere here.
Yeah. And it also goes back to Dr. Bob Morrison's program, right? The area regional control program, where that's the platform. You know, we didn't have a formal platform like we have now with U.S. SHIP. It has, you know, the kind of governing body. It has, you know, across the whole U.S. So we have representation and we have, you know, what you can call regions then, and we have mapping and we have sites enrolled. So I think that's the formal process we didn't have for that, the area regional control programs, that I think now is going to give us that, like you said, the basis and platform to share.
Yes. And we can start communicating. We can start talking. We can start, hey, let's work together on this. We can't do anything without that networking. So, and U.S. SHIP just makes it more formal, plus it's USDA codified. So it's a really important program. And again, credit to Roger and a lot of folks at Iowa State and the USDA for getting it going.
Yeah, and I think that piece of an eradication program is important. I know with pseudorabies, I was listening to a few historical presentations on, you know, how did we get that successfully eradicated? And it took a long time. And I came into my career at the very end of that process. But, you know, we had vaccination, we had zones, we had vaccinated herds and pigs moving that were vaccinated and some that weren't. And so the regulatory process is going to have to be part of this, and that U.S. SHIP can give us that arm already, you know, involved in the whole coordinated effort.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's really exciting.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
So Scott, what are we missing for successful elimination? Is there something we're missing?
I think the one thing we're missing is belief that it can be done. I think we have all the tools we need. We have all the information we need. We might even have resistant pigs that can be part of the solution too. They're not there yet, but the resistant pig reminds me of the pseudorabies vaccine. You know, that once we had the pseudorabies vaccine, the differential vaccine, it was very protective. It was a technology that really helped us advance. That's kind of where I see the resistant pig coming in. It's not perfect, but it's going to be a technology that we can apply to, you know, everything else we're doing. So it's really, that's something that could help us a lot in the future. So to me, the only thing we're missing, Tara, is belief and confidence, both from the producers and the veterinarian side, that this can be done. And there's so much evidence out there, farm after farm after farm. And you've done it. I've done it. Many of the listeners have done it. We can eliminate PRRS from a farm. That's not a problem. We just got to keep it out. Now we know how to keep it out because we have such a better biosecurity. So, you know, you look at the non-negotiables. We got to eliminate it from the country. Yes. We got to improve the national herd biosecurity. Yes. We got to change the way we move infected pigs around. Yes. And we got to have U.S. SHIP involved. Yes. So we're getting into some of these, like, platform, you know, now I call them non-negotiables, I guess, because we simply can't live without it. We have to have these processes and programs in place.
I had one of my questions was, what action can producers and veterinarians do today? And I think you just answered that, right? believe first, right? And get involved in U.S. SHIP and lead your farms to improve their biosecurity so you can keep it out and get on board.
The other thing producers and veterinarians can do, I think, is be more careful with live virus inoculation, which is a tactic where you collect serum from an infected pig and you use it as kind of a pseudo vaccine. And that's being done a lot around the U.S. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to do if it's not strategic. So every time you do that, just think you're going to infect a lot of animals and you're going to get a lot of virus shedding within the farm and outside of the farm. So to do that kind of helter skelter or just out of control, I think that's the wrong thing to do. And so to me, we can use that if we're going to eliminate, we can use that in our replacement kilts to immunize our replacement kilts in a GDU. So the replacement kilts for the next several months of the closure see that virus and get immunized. We're not going to be giving it to pregnant sows over and over again because that, I think, just keeps the virus alive and well. And every time PRRS gets in a pig, it's going to infect and it's going to potentially mutate and it's going to potentially produce a new virus. And that's how some of these new strains, I think, have come about. Some of these, you know, L1Cs and some of these ones we kind of talked about earlier that are so pathogenic, that's simply because, you know, repeated inoculation, repeated transmission, repeated mutation, that's how this virus survives. So we got to understand that. And I'm not saying we can't use LVI at all. We have to use it very strategically in a way that we minimize neighborhood spread and then maximize immunity for the elimination process in the replacement kill population. So that's another one of the non-negotiables I wrote in the first viewpoint. It's a bit controversial, but I think if we think about it, it's pretty hard to argue with what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that was one of the missing pieces, right, to the Minnesota area regional control program is the area spread and how the spread of the new virus can really, kind of go crazy, I would say, and really move. And so that's plays into that, what we know now that we didn't know then, but definitely we can have some more control over it.
Yeah, that's what brought all these area programs to their knees, was the inability to control virus spread within the area program. And now we know how that works, and we know some things we can't do. Pig movement, LVI, we got to be very strategic there. I'm not saying we're not going to ban any of that stuff. This isn't a regulatory thing, but we got to be more careful and more communicative with our neighbors on what we're doing at our farm.
So, Scott, what would a world without PRRS look like?
Well, I've seen it because in just my time in Pipestone, for example, we took PERS incidence or infectivity rate down below 10% for 3 years. And so that was amazing to go into those farms that don't have PERS. They haven't had PERS for several years, to see the welfare in the animals and the health of the animals, how welfarious it is, to see the smiles on the faces of the workers there, the pig caretakers, where they weren't carrying out buckets of dead pigs and dead sows all the time. They were actually going year after year after year without PERS. And then just to see the owners and their and the generations of new ownership thinking about coming back to the farm. Yeah, yeah. It sounds like it's a lot better place than it used to be when we were getting it every year. And literally, you remember this, they'd factored in the cash flow. We're going to get a new PERS break every year. So it's going to be $500,000 or something in the cash flow. We know it's going to happen. We're beyond that now. And changing that, that's the world without PERS, is not having to deal with this every single year, day after day after day, dealing with this disease on the farm. So that's, and I've seen it because I saw so many negative farms stay negative for a long period of time. So I know we can do it. There's no question we can do it. We just got to believe.
Absolutely. We're concluding our time together with Dr. Scott D. We've been discussing a world without PERS. It sounds too good to be true. I can't wait to see it. Yeah, and we've been learning how to get started and where to go from here. If you have comments or questions for Dr. D or our podcast show, please send those through on your platform. If you like our show, please give us a thumbs up or a like. Scott, before we sign off, any final thoughts for our listeners?
Just, you're in the greatest profession as a veterinarian. You're in the greatest industry as a pork producer. It's such a special place to be. And we have to be careful and protect our opportunities to practice veterinary medicine with pigs, to raise pigs, to feed the world. We can't take that for granted. And that's why we've got to eliminate this virus. Because eventually, some of the younger generations within each of those, you know, cohorts, producers, veterinarians, are they going to be able to come back to the farm? Are they going to be able to take care of the pigs? They care about economics, but they care more about animal welfare than talking to some of those, you know, Gen X and millennial folks. They care so much about the animal welfare side of it. And that's something we can never forget, is some of these younger people think a lot differently than perhaps people trained in my day, or maybe you're a lot younger than I am. So maybe you've got a little bit of that going on too. It's a different audience that we're talking to. And then we have to keep that in mind, that, you know, this isn't just dollars and cents. That's still there. It's not going to go away, but this is beyond that. This is animal welfare.
Yeah. And I think the PERS virus has changed over time and gotten so much more severe than when it first, knocked on our doorstep in the late 80s, 90s. And so that animal welfare is, like you said earlier in the show, it's changed, and it's a real wake up call for us to go after this virus.
I think one of the metric panels we need to develop is metrics for animal welfare in pig farms. So besides pigs per sow per year and farrowing rate and all that stuff, we also got to have a measure for welfare that we can look at the farm and say, where are we with these, you know, aspects? And so I don't know how to do that, but I know there's a lot of smart people that can help figure that out. But I think that's another panel of metrics that, besides economics and besides production, we have to start looking at and including in our day-to-day assessment of farms.
Yeah, and we have welfare assessments, but it doesn't necessarily look into the additive, all of the pieces that go into welfare and give a score, right? In terms of also, you know, curable diseases, right? That's maybe not looked at in those particular assessments today.
Yep, and we still have to keep pushing that we don't want to live with disease. We do not want to live with disease. We do not want to commingle pigs that are infected over and over and over and live with the disease. It's not going to work. It's going to get worse. We got to eliminate it. It's a complete change of culture, but that's where we have to go.
It's time for our famous three.
Broiler savvy.
The pioneering AI-powered solution for broiler gut functionality and metabolic efficiency insights. Cargill Animal Nutrition and Health Pork Solutions delivers trusted, data-driven nutrition and business support, helping you build more profitable, confident pork systems. KT Pacer, 50 years designing and building feed transportation equipment focused on quality, workmanship, and performance. BinSentry, the most trusted feed monitoring solution in the world.
Every pig, regain control of your wean-to-finish operation. Catch problems early, save pig lives.
Aurora Pharmaceutical, veterinary solutions for real-world animal care.
Tired of solving swine nutrition challenges alone? The Swine Nutrition Inner Circle connects swine nutritionists who share real insights on formulation, ingredient variability, and diet adjustments. When you need clarity, experts are just a conversation away. Join at swinenutritioninnercircle.com and connect with peers who understand the work you do every day.
That is where we have to go. Thank you so much for your leadership. Thanks for being on the show. But before I let you go, the hallmark of our Swine It podcast is to ask our guests three specific questions. So Scott, the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource that you use in your area of expertise?
Well, I don't really have one, but I'm writing one. I'm organizing one right now with a lot of veterinarians that we're organizing a textbook on animal biosecurity that will be used across veterinary libraries and for practitioners and students. We don't have a textbook with that type of scope. And so myself and many colleagues of mine from the AVMA across all different species are writing one. And so we're gonna have not just pigs, but we'll have cattle and poultry and all the small animals, bees, fish, the whole nine yards. We gotta be looking at animals with biosecurity focus and keeping disease out. So I don't have one right now, Tara, but I'm working on one.
Excellent. We'll look forward to that. How about a book or resource outside of your area of expertise that you think we should check out?
Well, so this is a little off the wall, but I'm a big left-right brain person. So I believe that the left brain is for the cognitive side of the world. The right brain is for your arts and those types of things. So I think when the two sides of the brain work together, you come up with some really different ideas. And that's kind of how I think I've come up with some of the experimental designs that I've used to figure out some of this PERS stuff. So one of the things I use to energize the right side of my brain is the Beatles White Album. So the Beatles put on the Beatles White Album. It's a two record set. It's 1968. That gets my right side of the brain just fired up. And then I can start have it work together with the left side to kind of come up with a plan for answering a specific question. So these probably aren't the regular answers you get from people, but that's some of the stuff I use to kind of keep everything firing.
The Beatles White Album. All right. I agree with the concept that doing something that uses your creative side will definitely stimulate some more scientific thought. So I've had it happen myself.
Yay. Good for you.
So the last one is share with us an attribute or characteristic that you feel sets successful professionals apart from others.
Graduate training. Training in the scientific process where you can go into a problem and you can develop a solution that's science-based and you've been trained how to do that. You're no longer just going to swag it. You're going to actually go and figure it out and use science, ideally even with statistics, to try to answer that question. So those kind of people that I've, learned a lot from, that's the way those guys think, is they put the science to it. To me, the going to grad school or going into some type of a training program, get some extra education, that's, I think, been really successful for me, but also for a lot of people that I pay a lot of attention to what they say.
Definitely need scientists and young scientists to keep going into our fields and continue to grow our knowledge.
That's
great.
Right.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being my guest. I look forward to next time.
Thanks, Tara. Appreciate it.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.